It's my honor this afternoon to introduce Ed Hine. I mentioned that he is a colleague with our group in Juneau, Alaska. He's also a professional colleague in that we both work for the federal government in Juneau. Ed walked off of the bayonet training field in basic training, declared himself a conscientious objector, and subsequently received an honorable discharge. He has turned to the power of the pen. He has written stories from Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza for U.S. newspapers. He also worked for the Seattle Times and the Omaha World Herald, and I know a secret in his past that he also wrote for the Anchorage Times, which is a serious Republican newspaper in Alaska. But we have forgiven him. Ed went on to law school. He graduated from the Seattle University School of Law. He's taught both law and journalism, and he has been with the feds since 94, where he works as an administrative law judge. He has a strong interest in constitutional law and in this topic and in peace, and he's a good guy. And so with that, I will step aside and allow these gentlemen to take over, and Mackenzie, keep an eye on him. Thanks a lot.
Well, that was the best part. He called me a good guy like that. This is a workshop that I thought of, the idea of doing, and asked Ray if he would be part of it, and he was gracious enough to do that. The title, Lies, Secrecy, and Lawlessness, just sort of popped into my mind after reading so many stories about what this administration has been doing since it declared an international war on terror. And it's very dismaying to me as a lawyer and as a citizen to see time and time again the various ways in which our leaders have trampled on the Constitution. At first I thought perhaps it was out of ignorance and inexperience, but I've come to believe quite some time ago that it is being done with great intention and great effect. And it's dismaying to me to have a sense that there are so many people in this country who really aren't paying all that much attention to it, who don't feel perhaps that we are in any kind of emergency, or worse, many people, I guess, express the idea, well, I've got nothing to hide, I've got nothing to worry about, this is only going to affect the terrorists or the bad guys or whatever. And that's probably a more dangerous attitude, because it reflects the sense that people don't understand how we are all connected and how the laws and the Constitution that protects us also has to protect those on the margins, those on the edges, those who are pushing the envelope on protesting, on anti-war, you name it. And so hopefully that's a lot of us as well. And we'll get into later whether any of you have experienced any problems from the government because of your activities against war in general, against the administration, what have you. And I should say, you know, as much as I'm talking about this administration, I don't want to give the impression that the Bush administration is the only problem. It's not only the executive branch. Congress is a problem. And it's not only this administration, it's previous administrations. If we really look at our history, we see that foreign policy for decades, century, has a lot of similarities in it, and the Bush administration did not invent these things. In fact, you know, the other thing is that I don't want to seem like I'm being partisan. Those of us who remember back to Vietnam recall clearly that first there was Mr. Johnson's war and then there was Mr. Nixon's war, and it really didn't matter that it was Democrat or Republican. It's sort of a bipartisan problem. So with that, you know, I think it's a particularly appropriate topic, this how to stop the coming police state, and maybe that's a little bit dramatic, but maybe it's not. Let's find out. But I think it's a particularly appropriate topic for this Veterans Convention, Veterans for Peace. All of us who were veterans, who are veterans and were once in the military service, took an oath at one point and to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. There's more to it than that, but that's the crux of it that I want to focus on today. And I don't know if any of you remember taking that oath, but there wasn't any expiration date on it. And I am calling on everyone here to try to remember that oath and the importance of it, and that we as veterans need to lead the rest of our country, our fellow countrymen, to save our country from what is really a very radical reinterpretation of our Constitution that's going on now. Most of the people who are in power in this administration are not lawyers, and there are a lot of people in the country who probably had a sigh of relief about that, because lawyers get blamed for a lot of problems. Well, there are some lawyers who are advising these guys, and I think they ought to be disbarred. But they have come up with this interpretation of the Constitution and the President's powers as Commander-in-Chief, and this so-called unitary executive theory that is really pretty far out there and is dangerous, and I think people need to be aware of it. I mean, they've come up with a whole new set of terms and terminology to go with it. But the basic idea is that they've adopted this view that during time of war and national emergency, the president, as commander-in-chief, as the chief executive, has the authority to do just about anything he wants, ignoring laws, breaking laws, making laws, because of the importance of national security. So there's this idea about, you know, why do they call this a coming police state, you know? Are we headed for Nazi Germany? Well, Nazi Germany was a long time ago. We're going to have an American version, and it's going to be different, but it's going to have some of the same elements, or it already does. Ray's going to talk about that somewhat. And so you judge for yourself. Are we already there? Are we headed there? Is it inevitable? Can we stop it? What can we do? And so we'll talk about that. And then what does it mean to support and defend the Constitution? I'll bet most of us, when we took that oath, didn't know what the heck we were supposed to do. I mean, to the extent we learned about the Constitution in high school or college, you know, how many people read the whole thing? How many people really understood it? I know there's been polls where they, you know, man on the street, they just say, well, they read off the ideas behind the Bill of Rights, and people say, no, I don't agree with that. That's crazy. So I think a lot of it is that people, for whatever reasons, have a lot of ignorance about what's in the Constitution and what it really means and how important it is for all of us. So we're going to talk about what's wrong, what's going on, and what can be done about it. And that's where you're all going to come in the second part of this workshop, because it's not just intended to be a lecture or a talk or a one-sided deal. We'd like to hear what you have to say about what we can do. I'll talk a little bit about what we've been doing in Juneau, Alaska, kind of the far reaches of the United States, as a chapter of Veterans for Peace. But I think we'd all like to hear what others of us have experienced and have learned. And let me just, I don't usually promote things, but let me just suggest a couple of readings for anybody who wants to get into this further. And I'm not sure if we've arranged to have this book. on the tables for sale out here, but if it isn't, you can certainly get it almost any bookstore now, and I think it's on a bestseller list. It's called How Would a Patriot Act, and this is by a New York lawyer who was a Republican and then started having second thoughts about what was going on with the Jose Padilla case and then other developments, and got very concerned. It's an excellent book. It's for the layperson. Anybody can understand it, and it really lays out point by point what's going on. And then secondly, you can get this on the web. The Cato Institute this year put out a study called Power Surge, the Constitutional Record of George W. Bush. And you can find this on their website, www.cato.org. And it's well worth reading, believe me. So I don't want to go into too much detail here. Let me just hit some of the main points. This, what I call a radical interpretation of the Constitution, gets down to the fundamental question of what is the president's role as commander-in-chief, and when does that apply? I mean, you may have noticed that the president, this president, likes to surround himself with the military, and that's been the case at least since 9/11. Seems to use the military as a backdrop for most of his speeches, and seems to be most comfortable when he's at military bases and on aircraft carriers and you name it. One would think that would draw attention to his own military service, but I don't know. But as commander-in-chief, you know, he has declared this war. I mean, again, there we go. Congress hasn't really declared a war here, but he's calling it the war on terrorism or war on terror. And, you know, when is that? When do we know when we've won? What's the ending going to look like? And I don't think there was ever any intent to have an ending. Anyone who's read George Orwell, 1984, you know, there's this theme that if you have a state of perpetual war and perpetual threat, and you create and maintain this atmosphere of constant fear, the public will more or less roll over and let you do things that they would never otherwise let you do because they're scared as hell. You know? And so I think that's what's going on here. It plays into the interests of the administration, which in the executive branch, they're trying to get more and more power to the executive. If you read about it, it goes back to the Nixon administration and Watergate and what happened as a consequence of that, how Congress stepped in and really clipped the feathers of the president. And we have a vice president and a secretary of defense who were around and remember and really did not like the loss of power in the executive and the gaining of it in the Congress. And now we've got a Congress that, well, you tell me, but where are they in terms of acting as an institutional check on the executive and the abuses? But this idea that is being espoused by a couple lawyers in particular, there's a lawyer named John Yoo, who was in the Justice Department, who is now a law professor in California. And there's another lawyer named David Addington, who worked for the vice president and now has become his chief of staff. And both of these guys have espoused this legal doctrine and theory that the executive basically can do whatever he wants, and it's exactly what these guys wanted to hear. And it's interesting, you have all these, shall we say, non-lawyers running the government, but they're looking for legal cover for what they're doing. I mean, I really think that they knew where they were headed. And one of the pieces of evidence of that is how so vehemently they opposed and basically withdrew from the International Criminal Court and pulled back from that. I always kind of wondered, Did they know that they intended to do things that would get them in trouble with the International Criminal Court if they did have jurisdiction, in particular torture and many other things? And Ray is going to speak to that issue too. So there's a real, I think, ruthlessness going on and results-oriented. We've got a group of people in power who are vengeful, who will go after anyone who disagrees with them or who creates an embarrassment for them. See the Joseph Wilson story, Valerie Plame, who will go after the press for leaking government secrets, but will use secrets themselves if it serves their interest. There's a certain feel of the mafia about this. But the mafia didn't go after people's wives, generally speaking. Anyway, I won't go on anymore. That's the basic idea. So where does the Constitution come in here? There's all these different... and where's my timekeeper? Oh, there you are. Thank you. There's so many different parts of the Constitution, it's hard to know where to begin, that are being touched by this. Let's start with the First Amendment. And the First Amendment, everybody, I guess, knows it's freedom of speech, but it's also freedom of the press. It's freedom of assembly and the right to petition your government. And all of these are being stepped on. The one that should be of interest to all of us is the government's efforts to infiltrate peace groups. And just to bring it home here to Seattle, the Seattle Raging Grannies. Now there is a scary group if you're an authoritarian. They are suing the federal government with the assistance of the local ACLU here to get access to records of any government surveillance of their activities. I think if you go on the web, you will also find that the Colorado chapter down in Denver of ACLU has brought some suits and several others around the country. So the right to assemble is being infringed. The right to freedom of speech. This Cato Institute study has some great anecdotes about. Has anybody heard of free speech zones? How many were at the Boston convention a couple years ago? Okay. And I wasn't, so maybe you can talk about this a little later, but it certainly happened, I believe, there and the Democratic Convention and other places where people had messages that they wanted to get to the president, and he just didn't really want to hear them. And so people were shunted off to areas that were fenced in, that were behind buses, basically so that they could not be heard or seen by the president. So it's a bipartisan problem, isn't it? And really, that's a good point, because all of the things that are being done now, if they are left standing, if we allow them to continue, they will be used by future presidents of both parties. It will establish a tradition, a precedent, and if the message is, well, we as citizens don't care enough about it, they will continue to do it, because power is power, regardless of what party label it has on it. And I worry, too, about people who think that if we can just get the Republicans out of office, everything will be better. And how many liberals are willing to protest the war and protest the kinds of abuses that have been going on if it is a liberal Democratic president? Are we going to lose members? Are people going to fall away because they don't want to seem like they're adding ammunition to the other side? But the other side are the people who benefit from promoting war. I'll just read a little bit from this. And how am I doing on... Okay, I'll finish up real quick then. Let me just say we've got free speech zones. We've got NSA eavesdropping without warrants and without review by the FISA courts. We've got an official but unacknowledged policy of using torture whenever it serves or supposedly serves our interests. We have the denial of habeas corpus. We have people kept in prison indefinitely without charges, without opportunity to have a lawyer or to go into court and to challenge the whole thing. We've got people who've been imprisoned for 2 and 3 and more years without any charges brought. We had the executive branch create military commissions in which there were virtually none of the usual safeguards of a fair trial, and in which the president basically decided who was an enemy combatant and what punishment that person should be given when they are convicted, when they are given justice, in other words, in their view. Just on and on you can go. And the whole idea of the checks and balances and separation of powers that is built into the Constitution is being challenged in this theory that the judicial branch does not have the authority to review what the president does in matters of military is so radical and dangerous that if you had to focus on one thing, I would do that one. So let me just sum it up there. Patriot Act, of course, I should throw that in. You know, I don't know where we're going or how much the American public will tolerate before we can do something to stop it. But, you know, in 2003, I remember I had just joined Veterans for Peace, thanks to Phil, invited me. And in Juneau, Alaska, it's a small town, basically 30,000 people, and we have a 4th of July parade every year, and all sorts of people get involved. And Veterans for Peace started marching that year. But I didn't march with Veterans for Peace. I paid my $5 and had a one-person entry in the parade, and I called it Friends of the Constitution. And I called all the other lawyers and the Bar Association and the judges around town and invited them to join me. And wasn't really sure how many would, but I expected if anybody did, these guys should, because we've all taken oaths to support and defend the Constitution as lawyers. So I've done it twice. Bush has done it twice, too, by the way. And so I got out there, and I had a couple of friends. We made a couple dozen signs, and I was wondering if I was just going to not be able to carry them all. You know, things like fair trial, you know, freedom of speech, just simple things like that. And lo and behold, about 25 people came and joined me, and I got rid of all the signs, and we marched together, and it was pretty good. But one little other note before I turn this over to Ray. In preparation for that, I got a call from the local radio station, and there was an intern out there for the summer who wanted to do a little news story over the phone. And she said to me, this is off the air, she was taping it, and she said, Mr. Hine, aren't you afraid of what people will think and what people might do, what they might threaten you for doing this? And I thought, isn't that interesting? I said, it's a pretty sad commentary when it is thought to be radical and dangerous to stand up for the Constitution of the United States. What could be more American and patriotic? You know, I didn't think there was anything even risky about it, let alone radical. But it was, you know, it was 2003. A lot of fear and a lot of funny attitudes come out. So, well, my time's up. I'm going to turn this over to this guy. And I guess I'm supposed to do a quick introduction about Ray. I wrote the little bio about him on the website for this. So I guess I can say, and I met Ray, fortunately, in the fall of 2004. One of our chapter members, who's a World War II vet and served at the Battle of the Bulge, he's our oldest member in our Juneau chapter, is a good longtime friend of Ray's, and really introduced us to him by bringing him up to Juneau, where Ray spoke before our World Affairs Council that fall. And I had the good fortune of going out afterwards to dinner and of taping his talk and sending him the disc. And Ray, for those of you who may not know, first of all, he's a veteran from the Army. And was it military intelligence, am I correct? And then spent about 27 years with the CIA as an analyst. And, you know, I have to say, when Ray came to talk in Juneau, I said, we're going to listen to a CIA guy talk about what's going on, that's before I knew Ray. And maybe many of you first heard about Ray when he was on CNN several months ago confronting Donald Rumsfeld about why Donald lied to all of us. You know, and Ray said in his talk in Juneau that, you know, the code, the ideal of the CIA analyst was to speak truth to power and not be afraid to tell the administration what we know and let them make the judgments, but not just be telling people what you think they want to hear. Anyway, since retiring, Ray has formed a group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, the VIPs, and from all different intelligence agencies, a bunch of retired guys, and they're raising hell back in Washington. And I'll also mention that, you know, he particularly doesn't like the fact that the CIA has been involved in torturing people and teaching others to do it and using proxies. And so several months ago, he and a bunch of these other VIPs walked down the halls of Congress in orange jumpsuits like they were in Guantanamo with, was it duct tape over your mouth or something like that, and the word torture, and tried to send a message. And then he went into Representative Hoekstra's office and returned his medal that he had received, an award from the CIA. So I've said too much. Ray, go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to start out with a very short poem. It was written in 1935, 2 years after Hitler took over in Germany, written by Peter Gahn. But first, the most important thing. What are you doing in these great times? Great, I say, for times seem great to me when each man driven half to death by the era's hate, and standing in the place he's given, must willy-nilly contemplate no less a thing than his own being. A little breath, a second's wait may well suffice. You catch my meaning? Now, I'm a little slow on poems, and I assume some of the others of you don't get it the first time. I'm going to read it one more time. But first, the most important thing. What are you doing in these great times? Great, I say, for times seem great to me when each man, driven half to death by era's hate, and standing in the place he's given, must willy-nilly contemplate no less a thing than his own being. A little breath, a second's wait, may well suffice. You catch my meaning? I was born in August of 1939, 1 week before Hitler sent his tanks into Poland, justifying it with a pretext that the Poles had fired or maybe captured 2 German soldiers. And I've always been fascinated by that particular period of time in German history. I'm an amateur historian, and I lived in Germany for 5 years, during which time I had all manner of opportunity to ask the Germans, young and old, how could it be? How could it be that you, the most educated, among the most cultivated people in the Western world, how could you sit by and watch Hitler do what he did? How could you keep silence? How could your churches, your Catholic, your Lutheran church, not find their voices in watching what was going on? How could it be? And I never got a satisfactory answer to that, never. A correspondent I know recommended a book to me which helps with the answer. It's called Defying Hitler by Sebastian Hafner. And I want to cite a few passages for this because they have an eerie parallel with what's going on now. Why, for example, it strikes me to ask, were the World War I veterans, the German World War I veterans, why were they unable to tell their fellow citizens what war was like? Why didn't they step up to the plate and say, this is idiocy? In trying to explain how it could be that the Germans caved in the way they did, Hafner says there was something further that was necessary to achieve this result. And it was the cowardly treachery of all party and organizational leaders. All party and organizational leaders. The betrayal was complete from left to right. What about the Social Democrats? Their betrayal of their blindly loyal millions of followers was particularly dreadful and humiliating because they parodied, actually they recited the Nazi slogans. Some politicians today recite the opposition's slogans like cut and run and we must stay and that kind of thing. The great middle class Catholic Party Zentrum, which in the last few years had attracted quite a backing, they fell apart in March, the same year that the Reichstagsfeier took place. And finally, what about the right-wing German conservatives? I quote here, "Oh God, what an infinitely cowardly spectacle their leaders made in 1933 and continued to make thereafter. They went along with everything, the terror, the persecution of Jews, everything." As Ed mentioned, before the war, actually 3 months before the war, we founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Why? Well, because we could see our profession being corrupted, being really prostituted, and that hurt. It hurt even more when we saw that our profession was being corrupted in order to deceive our elected representatives in the Congress out of their constitutional prerogative to declare war or to authorize war. That seemed to us a constitutional crisis, even more damaging than the damage that our profession had incurred. And so a lot of us felt more than just a little bit angry. Now, I think many of you have had to deal with this, but I could just speak out of my own experience. When I was growing up in the Bronx, it was frowned on to be angry for very long. I mean, you could be angry for a day or two. If you were Irish, they'd give you a week, you know, you could be angry. But if you kept being angry, there was something wrong with that. And, you know, every now and then it occurs to me, something I'm reminded of from my college days at Fordham University in New York. And there we had to study a lot of Thomas Aquinas, so much so that colleagues in other universities used to call us peeping Thomists. Now, Thomas was wrong about a lot of things he didn't know about women, for example. But he's right about certain things, some philosophical principles like virtue. And he adopted this Pythagorean idea that virtue is always in the middle, okay? So too much of something's no good, too little also not good. Take courage, for example, okay? Courage is just enough of what you need, the virtue. Too much foolhardiness, no good. Cowardice, also no good. Well, Thomas cited John Chrysostom from the early church, 4th century, who said, "He or she who is not angry when there is just cause for anger sins." Why? Because anger looks to the good of justice. And if you can live amid injustice without anger, you are unjust. Thomas added his own little corollary to that. He railed against what he called unreasoned patience. Now, think about what unreasoned patience might mean, folks. That's the best translation we can make from the Latin. He defined it. He said, unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and encourages not only bad people, but good people to do evil. I have 6 grandchildren, and one of the youngest, her name is Claire, she lives in Oakland. She was watching me on TV one time because my wife had time to tell my daughter that I was on. And after it was over, she turned to my daughter and she said, Mommy, that was Grandpa. And Kathleen said, yeah. She said, well, Mommy, that means the other people are real too. Now, why do I cite that? It's cute on the surface. But folks, if you don't know somebody in the picture, the other people aren't real too. We don't even have pictures of Iraq. We don't have pictures of Jose Padilla or the other people who are, or the people who are holed up in Guantanamo trying to just end their lives because it's too difficult to live. We used to have pictures, at least in Vietnam. And so it's hard. It's very hard to know someone in the picture and to identify with that in an emotional way. Now, Cindy had someone in the picture. Cindy's here now. You're not here, are you, Cindy? No, she's resting, I believe. She's been fasting all this time since the 3rd of July. Her son, Casey, was in the picture. And so she was appropriately angry. And we all have buddies, Army, Navy, Air Force buddies. We've been in the picture. We've been there, done that. So some of us have more immediate experience there. And this is a credential. This is something that gives credibility to us. I mean, there are people that think, since I worked in the CIA for 27 years, that I must know something. Now, true or false, it's a cachet, you know, it's a piece of credibility. And what I'm trying to do is put it in play to the extent I can in search of spreading some truth around. This time, unlike Vietnam, when there were pictures, when you knew someone in the picture, when we were in the picture, this time it's different. It's very different, and I want to recite some of the ways it's different. One of the big sea changes that I've observed in Washington for the last 43 years is the fact that we no longer have a free media. Have you noticed? We have a domesticated media. We find great difficulty finding the truth, okay? Now, on the other side of that, we do have the web, we have the internet, and that's a subject for a separate conversation because there's got to be ways, folks, there's got to be ways that we could use that more imaginatively than we do so far. The other thing, of course, is there's no draft. This is a biggie. No draft. Obvious implications there. Another is that there are no prophets like Martin Luther King Jr. with the guts to speak out. Now, that really took guts because all his closest advisors told him, look, don't prejudice the chances of our civil rights movement by taking off against the war. But for Martin, it was a seamless garment. And even then, in Vietnam, the churches came around belatedly, but they did come around. And I have to say, from what I've seen of the institutional church in this country and most of the other faiths, they're still riding shotgun for the system. And the other thing, and it's no small thing, and actually I adopted this thing, I didn't realize it was 2 years ago, for my little Juno presentation at the World Affairs Council, I used the acronym OIL. As the real reasons why we got into Iraq. Some of you have heard that before. But suffice it to say that Vietnam had no oil to speak of. It was not really close to Israel, so no threat to Israel. And it didn't provide the logistical base that we thought we needed to dominate the oil supplies in the Middle East. It was a little bit farther away for that. That's a biggie as well. But you know what else is different? We're around. We who have been there, done that, we're around. I remember Ramsey Clark speaking at a meeting in Washington a couple months ago. And he said, you know, well, somebody asked him, they said, you know, people have written about the U.S. history, you know, people's history of the United States and so forth. This has happened before. You know, what's different now? And Ramsey,
jolted up and he said, the difference is that we're here now. We're here now and we can do something about it. That's the difference. Hello? You know?
We're here now and we can do something about it. Especially when we watch a president of the United States and his defense minister treating our soldiers, sailors, and Marines like disposable troops. I mean, it's almost like soldiers that a rich kid gets for Christmas and can play with and knock them off the bedspread when he wants, or who cares about them? That's how bad it is. And we should all feel that, and I'm sure we all do feel that pretty deeply. The other difference is we still have time. Now, time is important. Martin Luther King famously said in that same speech on Vietnam, he said, there is such a thing as too late. And I think we're approaching that time now. Let me tell you about one German who did speak out. Most of us know about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but this was a fellow in the same sort of age group who was quiet before the war. His name was Albrecht Haushofer, and he was a geolog, a geologist or geographer at the University of Berlin, and he had tenure. Some of you know what tenure means. He had it made, and he had it made mostly because he kept his mouth shut. When the war started, his conscience got to him, okay? And he started speaking out strongly, acquired a actually a major following, wrapped up by the SS, put into a different Berlin prison from the one that Bonhoeffer was in. Well, the SS, typically Germanic way, they insisted that each person before they executed them, whether they hanged them or whether they shot them, they had to write a written confession. And Haushofer refused to do that. And they got increasingly impatient, and finally they shot him anyway. Well, when they picked him off the floor, out of his pocket fell a little zettel, a little piece of paper on which he had written his confession. And it's short, and I'd like to recite it for you. The title was Schuld, the German word for guilt. Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. I should have earlier recognized my duty. Ich musste schärfer Unheil nennen. I should have more sharply called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. I put off my judgment far too long. Ich habe gewarnt. I did warn. And as I mentioned, he did warn. Aber nicht genug. Genug is the German word for enough, okay? Nicht genug und klar. Klar, clear, claro, klar. Clear is clear, okay? So ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today, I recognize what I was guilty of. Now, Martin Luther King famously said in that speech I just mentioned, we must be prepared to match actions with the words we speak by seeking out every creative means of protest possible. I just feel very honored to be here at a conference the year after you all rose to the occasion when Cindy Sheehan got up here and said, I think I'll go over to Crawford and ask the president what this noble cause is. You guys really did all of us proud. You and Code Pink, because you went with her. You supported her. And the tradition out of which I come says very firmly that the first duty of discipleship is to encourage one another. And that's what I see around here all the time I've been here so far. We need to keep encouraging one another, and that's precisely what you all did for Cindy. I'd say that as I think about Cindy, as I think about Code Pink, and I'm proud to wear my Code Pink t-shirt, as I think about the raging grannies, well, one thing I ask myself is, well, where are the raging grandpas? Where are the raging grandpas?
I think we need to let women lead. They tend to be more imaginative, and truth be told, they seem to be a little bit more gutsy, many of them. I think we also need to recognize that sometimes we're called to do bizarre things. We can talk about some of our experiences. I can tell you how I got arrested with a Catholic worker and learned a heck of a lot a couple of years ago. But to Jeremiah, from some of our common tradition there, Jeremiah, most of you probably have forgotten that he walked around stark naked for about 5 years. Yeah, okay. Now the exegetes, the biblical scholars, tend to say, well, it's not clear that he was naked all the time, just during liturgical services. That may be true, but it doesn't let the man off the hook, you know? Now, what was he saying? What was he trying to say? I think he was trying to say, look, I strip myself naked, trying to call attention to the injustices that I see around me. And you say, oh, isn't that terrible? But you, my friends, you are stripped of the vision given you by Yahweh, a vision of justice and shalom. Your nakedness is much more despicable. That's what Jeremiah was saying. And I think we all have to find our own ways to do this. Now, some of us consider ourselves already a little bit eccentric, and so we have to be, you know, a little careful. We may just be a bunch of kooks, you know. But so the restraining attitude on this simply is, we do best when we do things in community. And I see a lot of community around here, but if you're going to do something like this, it's always good to check it out with a few close friends. That's not to say something like this. It doesn't have to be, you know. We could go downtown, I suppose, later this evening. Other thing I just want to mention that sort of occurred to me as Ed was speaking, you couldn't do things alone. I mean, there's little things that really are helpful. Somebody gave me a bumper sticker which says, when Jesus said, love your enemies, I think he probably meant not to kill them. There's another one. This is a good story. I was speaking before the election 2 years ago in Columbus, Ohio, in a very ritzy suburb of Columbus, and a woman said that she was just distraught because she was so much turned off by what was going on in the country, but everyone there seemed to be very strong supporters of Bush. And then finally she pulled into this shopping center, and there was a car in front of her with a bumper sticker that said ABB. You remember that from a couple of years ago? Anybody but Bush. And she said her heart leapt. And she waited in her car until a lady came out, 45 minutes. And she went up to the lady and she said, does that bumper sticker mean what I think it means? And she said, yes. And out of those two women, arose a peace movement in that little suburb, which actually, through that district, behind Bush's opponent, I forget what his name was, 2 years ago. What Ed mentioned about his own witness there and joining the parade without being assured of anybody to be with him, well, that's a way of forming community, because a community of some 25 formed around that. So I think that we have to sort of recognize what should be obvious, and that is that this November is critically important. Critically important. That's why Scott Ritter and I are going around to various cities and towns trying to spread as much word around in a nonpartisan way about how we got into Iraq, how we should get out, and how we should not get into Iran. It's very instructive, and if it happens to hurt the fortunes of some of the politicos that are still defending this misbegotten war, then that's not our fault. Lots of bad stuff is going on. Ed mentioned already torture, eavesdropping, kidnapping, secret prisons, disregard of habeas corpus. I mean, habeas corpus was wrested from those English lords. Was that 1215 or something like that? That's a long time ago. And we're going back on that? Jose Padilla happens to be from the Bronx, like me. What's the difference between Jose Padilla and me? Tommy Franks said that if there was another terrorist incident,
that would probably result in a military dictatorship. And last, I'll just mention something that affects me personally, or may, and that's something probably none of you know about, but the Intelligence Authorization Bill that has passed the full House has a Section 413 in it, which says, and I quote, "The Director of National Intelligence shall perform a study to investigate whether he already has the authorities to revoke the pensions of CIA alumni who discuss classified information, or whether he needs additional authorities." Now, folks, that's creeping fascism, if there ever was. I don't go around discussing classified information, but who defines what's classified information? Certainly not my colleagues and I. So be aware that this stuff is really pretty insidious. And I'd like to close here by quoting one of the people who has inspired me over the years. He happens to be a prophet. He happens to be a Jesuit. It's about another war, folks. But many of you know about this other war. Dan Berrigan. "We have assumed the name of peacemakers, but we have been, by and large, unwilling to pay any significant price." Now, I know I'm talking to the choir here, but I think we need to have this sink into our own consciousness for our discussions with our brothers and sisters, neighbors, and other associates. Because we want peace with half a heart, half a life, half a will, the war, of course, continues, Vietnam. Why? Because the waging of war, by its very nature, is total. But the waging of peace, by our own cowardice, is partial. Of course, let us have peace, we cry, but at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison, nor ill repute, nor disruption of ties. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as disruptive, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison and death in its wake. That's the challenge before us, folks. Are we willing to stick our necks out? Now, I have nothing against necks. They're pleasant. They're a convenient connection between head and torso. But if there is nothing for which you will risk that neck, then that neck has become your idol. And necks are not worthy of that. Now, again, I'm preaching to the choir here, but we need to inspire other folks to stick their necks out as well in the 3 months we have left to save our republic. I'll finish with this little quote from Dante, also a poet, who said, "The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who remain neutral in times of crisis." Now, just for fun, yesterday I Googled hell, and the temperature there was 135, which is even hotter than Crawford in August. So let that be a word for us to take that away. Thank you very much.
We go to 515.
I've heard a lot of talk of comparisons between where we are in the United States at this point in time and that of pre-World War II Germany. Daniel Ellsberg talked about it. You've talked about it. But I haven't heard anybody talk further about it than trying to make these comparisons, when in fact, if what you're suggesting is true, everybody in this room already has their butt on the line, and possibly. But certainly you folks on the stage, absolutely, have your butts on the line. Would you care to comment on, there's been rumors of internment camps being built in the United States. I don't for 1 minute think that this administration is at all dumb. Okay, I wouldn't underestimate them. And if in fact what you're suggesting is true, they already know what's going on here. Okay? And if they're not dumb, then they have some plan in store for those of us that seek peace in the world. What do you think?
Well, I'll just make one comment that Ray respond to. It's a good question, and it seems to me that the administration is going to bother with somebody until they get to the point where they think they're somehow threatening. So if you're not doing enough to make them feel a little bit afraid of you, then you got nothing to worry about.
Yeah, is this on?
Yeah,
I just say that I wouldn't put anything beyond this crew. The more I watch Cheney, you know, it's very easy to believe the unbelievable. And I think we do a big favor to our fellow citizens by exploring each and every one of these leads. I'd like to know more about these camps that are going up, Halliburton's putting up. I'd really like a definitive answer from the federal government. Now, so far, today, we can appeal for that, and we can take legal measures to secure it. After the next terrorist incident, real or contrived, it's going to be harder. So that's why I feel a real sense of urgency here. I mean, if the Congress changes, if the House changes hands, okay, our president will be impeached, okay? And that's, as just the gentleman just said, he's not going to sit back and take that. And so put yourself in the mindset of Rove, Bush, Cheney. What are they going to do between now and the election to make sure that doesn't happen? Now, if they have the voting machines all fixed, no sweat, okay? But maybe they don't have the voting machines all fixed. What will they do? Well, my bet is that they may just do the equivalent of Napoleon and Hitler marching on Moscow, okay? And that would be to march on Iran in a way that they think the Air Force can handle. So what we need to do is just exercise every right we have without being worried about you know, this other stuff. We're all together. Caesar, who was it? No, Vaclav Havel said, they can't put us all in prison. And that's why, you know, we hang together and we do what we can. We still come. Yeah.
I wanted to ask Mr. McGovern, you know, about the recent information that's came out about this database, you know, with the NSA spying that they actually, I think it was in the Padilla case, this came from Discovery, right, that they mm-hmm. were negotiating with the NSA 7 months before 9/11, you know, on being able to spy on everybody and tap our phones. And since you were in the CIA and in the intelligence business, if you have any ideas what they want with this, Greg Palast says mm-hmm. that he thinks that has to do with who to disappear from the voting rolls. You know, I think it probably has a lot to do with spying on their political enemies, but could you maybe comment on the significance of this?
Well, that's exactly right. People forget why the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was put into law in 1978. J. Edgar Hoover, some of you are old enough to remember him, he was doing all manner of political blackmail with the eavesdropping that he was doing. It was awful. Senators, representatives, members of the administration, very high official presidents, okay? That's why they did the law, folks, okay? Now, take Senator Specter, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. When he heard about this illegal, warrantless eavesdropping, what did he say? Oh, this is extra legal. We got to look into this right away. We're going to do something about that, you know? What does he say now? Oh, I think we ought to do this legislation which gives the president carte blanche to do this and exculpates him from having done it in the past. Now, what changed his mind? Well, this is going to sound a little far out for you, but those of us that grew up in the J. Edgar Hoover era would be open to the possibility that Senator Specter got a visit from the FBI, and the FBI fellow says, you know, we know about Elsa Martinez in Cleveland, and we noticed that you go there every weekend, and we've actually been talking to Elsa, and I think that, I think probably be in everybody's benefit if you didn't press this constitutional stuff about warrantless eavesdropping and give us a better break. So, now, what am I suggesting? I'm suggesting precisely that, because Specter, in my experience, has shown some respect for the law and the Constitution. So what changed his mind? Not only to give in, but to give the president carte blanche. It could be something as easy as having intercepted communications between him and some mistress, I'm not saying he has one, in Cleveland, whom he visits everything. That's the kind of information people can use, okay? Sorry.
Okay. Thank you all.